Good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, Jean-Marc Grodi, here in EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege to come together to hear a story of the good things the Lord has done in our lives. And tonight, we're joined by Dr. Brandon Vaidyanathan. He's a former Hindu. He's the associate professor and chair, Department of Sociology at the Catholic University of America. Brandon, thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I really appreciate you being here to share your story from a little bit further than we usually have backgrounds from. We're often talking to Protestants, evangelicals, a former Hindu today. Excited to hear about that.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up. Hindu. I grew up in not in India. My parents are from India, but they moved to the Middle East. So I was born in Qatar, and I spent my childhood mostly in Oman, which is a sleepy country on the Arabian Gulf, and very peaceful place, but not much happens there. And I would find myself growing up there in a sort of a pan-Indian environment. So a lot of Indian guest workers in the Arabian Gulf. And so I was growing up immersed in an Indian community, but not people from my parents' background, but other parts of the country. So it's very multicultural in that sense. And I my parents are very devout. They're Brahmins. So the Brahmins are sort of the highest caste in Hinduism, and they're very devout. And I, as a little kid, was very pious. I would go to the temple. I would pray. I would read a lot of Hindu mythology, which I had in the form of comic books. And it was really, that really shaped my imagination as a child. Just sort of these gods with superpowers and quite. I'd say that as a child, a lot of watching my parents pray was really, I think, influential for me, just to see how important it was in their life. But a lot of our faith, I would say, was very transactional in the sense that what I was taught to pray for was health and wealth and success in my studies, and that was really it. So I'd see this contrast between in these stories I'm reading about these people who are making immense sacrifices, sometimes to try to manipulate God, but sometimes just out of love. And I didn't really see that in the version of religion that was given to me, which was much more about material success. And so I found that kind of odd. And then, as growing up as a child, I found myself, so we were moving around a lot throughout the Middle East. My dad would get a new job or he'd get transferred. And so we moved to different cities a lot. And I felt that I had to constantly reinvent myself. And I was always trying to be the best at my studies, the best at sports and so on, in part because my dad's motivational strategy was to tell me that I was worthless if I was not the best. So it's not what he actually believed, but India's, a very competitive country. And I think, having left that environment because it was hard to come by jobs there, I think he really wanted, me to develop a thick skin, but also really to be competitive. But all of that kind of warped into a very strange spirituality where it was really about any kind of prayer was about success. And there was one point when I was about 10 years old when I had a kid in my class whose dad had a heart attack. And that was the first time I made a really earnest prayer for someone else that I recall. And I really sincerely prayed to God because I couldn't imagine my life without my dad and having this guy, if he died, I couldn't imagine what his life would be like. And I prayed very earnestly for a long time, asking God to that this man should live. And he died. And that just killed something in me. And it made me sort of wonder as to, what's the point of prayer? And around that time, my mother, who was a physician, also started experiencing hallucinations. So she's having psychotic episodes. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly, she developed sort of full-blown schizophrenia. And then she went untreated for about 10 years. So I watched her decline. I watched a woman who was playful and fun and would spend time with me become really aloof and almost catatonic and talk to herself and couldn't work anymore. And all of that started happening around the time I was about 10. And so prayer did nothing for that either. And so from that point, effectively, I became an atheist and well into my teens, couldn't believe that there was any point in prayer or maybe out of superstition, I would touch an idol of a god just so that I don't get bad luck doesn't inflict me. But there was no kind of the devotion that I had as a kid, it completely was gone. So let's fast forward to the time I started high school, and so we'd moved around a lot, and I ended up in Dubai, In the United Arab Emirates, and I started my grade 11 year of school there. And by the end of that year, I was the top student in the school. I was, the captain of sports teams and one of the four houses in the school and lots of accolades. And this was, I thought, the pinnacle of my success. And I was on track to go to the U.S. on a full scholarship. And then by this time, I had come to hate my parents and I wanted to get out of their hair and just sort of leave them and never look back, never return. So that was my plan. And then I fell in love. I fell in love with a girl who happened to be Catholic. And she was from a part of India that was colonized by the Portuguese. So Goa is a part of India where a lot of people of Portuguese descent with Portuguese last names and so on. And so we fell in love. We had this clandestine relationship because we were from different cultures. Our parents would not have allowed us to be together. We're still in high school, so we wouldn't have been allowed to date. And we're in the Middle East where, even though Dubai is a bit more progressive, it's still not the kind of, you wouldn't be really allowed to be alone in a car with somebody of the opposite sex who is not related to you. And so all kinds of trouble could brew from people knowing we were together. And so we kept this a secret. And I started to realize that everything I'd been doing, all of the success I was striving for, was simply so that I could have someone tell me she loved me. And once I had that, I didn't care about school and success and all of that. And so what happened was, we were in a school where the girls would go to school from 6 a.m. to 12 p.m., and then the boys would go from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m., right? So the two shifts. I would get on the school bus, and instead of going to school, would go to her house and would spend time with her several days a week. So I was missing classes. Started failing out of exams and started getting a lot of trouble with the principal of the school and so on. And they didn't know what was happening to me. They thought I was onto drugs or something, and would call my parents, and my dad would be furious, and we get into fights, and life at home became really chaotic and miserable. And that made me all the more cling to this girl. So I was escaping from my turbulent home environment. She was also escaping from a chaotic home environment. Her dad was an alcoholic and so on. So a year into this relationship, she called me one day and announced something to me. She said, "I've been seeing someone else for the last 3 months." Now, I didn't see this coming. The guy she was seeing on the side was somebody I had introduced her to, and he's somebody I had known for about 10 years. And he was in three different cities in which I had lived and would just show up like this ominous figure. And when he showed up in Dubai 3 months earlier, I introduced him to my girlfriend. And then he didn't know the two of us were together, so he asked her out, and she agreed and didn't tell him that the two of us were together, right? So she called me to tell me, "I'm seeing this guy, I've been seeing him for the last 3 months. I'm calling to ask for your permission to see him officially as my boyfriend while you continue on as my best friend." And that was the most absurd,
oh boy,
the most absurd experience.
Yeah.
Because it was I would have understood if she said, "Look, things aren't going well, let's break up." That would have made sense. This was insane. Like, this was completely absurd. And I couldn't compute it. My entire world collapsed. I couldn't understand what she was doing. And eventually I managed to say, "No, it's him or me. What the hell's wrong with you?" And, slammed the phone down, called him up and told him, "She's mine, back off." And he's like, "Oh, I didn't know you guys were together." But no, I'm not backing off because no girl has ever liked me before. So, so we were at this impasse and I thought, well, I have to, figure out some way to get this guy into trouble. And then I learned that the two of them, both of them were Catholic, were going to go to this church retreat. So it was the first youth retreat in Dubai. It was a part of something called Youth 2000. So they have these programs all over the world.
Yeah.
And so they had a big thing in Dubai, and it was going to be the first Arabia, youth retreat at a church for a weekend. And the thought of them spending a weekend together was unbearable for me. So I had my final exams and I was failing. I was, I didn't know if I would pass my grade 12. It's a private school. My dad had paid a ton of money for me to go through that. He was in complete anguish at seeing my academic career unravel. He didn't know what was going on. And then there's this retreat going on just at the end of that weekend. And I said, "I'm going to go there. And I'm going to be a nuisance, and how can they do this religious BS after what you did to me?" I said, "I'm going to go and make them feel guilty and miserable and denounce them." I had all this fury. And then my dad's standing there, like, as I'm packing up, he's like, what are you doing?" I'm like, I'm going away. I couldn't say I'm going to church because that would make no sense at all. And he said, "You're not doing that." And he stood and blocked the door, and I punched him in the face, pushed him out of the way, ran out, got a cab, and went to the Catholic parish.
Wow.
Where we had this weekend retreat. And I found myself, the way I got into the retreat was I knew the choir director. And I used to sing, and I told him I want to be part of this thing. And so in the choir, singing praise and worship songs, you know.
Hold on. Just a moment, right? Because just a couple things before we pick up this exciting narrative. Because you're singing praise and worship songs. Uh-huh. I mean, up to meeting this girl, did you have any even sense of what Christianity was? Did it fit in your worldview?
No, I mean, so I knew people who were Christian, but I'd never really. I mean, so she went to to choir practice a few times, I would accompany her. So I'd been to this group. Mm-hmm. But I had no interest in religion, obviously, and it was just another one of these various religious systems. Okay. And in fact, the only dealings I had, let's say, with Christianity, had to do with, at some point in our relationship, this girl telling me that she wanted to take her faith more seriously, and so we had to change. Our behavior was inappropriate, and I thought, who's this Jesus dude, and why is he, getting in our way? And so I wanted to pull her out of that. That was the only kind of interaction that I had with religious belief, really, and with Christianity. And so, so I found myself in this choir. I mean, I'd been in a part of other choirs, and we'd sung Christian hymns, but they were not sung out of a spirit of prayer. They were just a performance, right?
Sure.
Whereas now this was meant to be for the sake of drawing people into prayer. Mm-hmm. And I'm standing there, and I know the music, and we're singing all this, open the door to the King of Kings and so on, and watching, glaring at these two, trying to make them feel as uncomfortable as possible. Both of them were in the choir as well. Mm-hmm. But I found... during that retreat, these moments, we had these moments of reflection, the Eucharistic adoration and so on, and there were these moments during which I was really forced to be with myself and confront the facts that I was so sure I knew where my life was going. I had all these plans, then I met this girl, and I was so sure I was going to marry her, and really, for me, it was a sense of, it's us against the world, our parents are not going to approve it, but I had all these narratives that came out of Bollywood movies and so on about, the young couple defying the odds and making it on their own. And all of that was over. Like, I couldn't imagine how we would, how that life would happen. Mm-hmm. And I had nothing to live for. I was probably going to fail my exams. I couldn't imagine living my life in my house, just being, back stuck with my parents. I had nothing else to live for. Mm-hmm. So I made another earnest prayer for the first time in, 8 years at that point, saying, all right, here are all these people claiming to believe in you and claiming that this stuff is real. If there's anything out there, if there's anyone out there, I want some proof. And that was really the prayer, because I had no idea what to do. Like it was really like hitting rock bottom, as it were, right? I did nothing else. And the answer to my prayer came in a very unexpected way. And I found myself after the retreat... when I saw this girl, it was a couple of days after the retreat ended, and then was Good Friday a couple of days later. I'd gone back and started my exams, and I came back to church. I found myself seeing this girl on Good Friday of 1998, the sweltering heat of Dubai. It's really like 120 degrees outside. There's this procession out there. I see this girl. She looks at me. She hasn't seen me in a while. Starts to cry because I haven't yet given her this permission. Mm. I go up to her. I didn't know what I would say to her, but I found myself telling her, if you want to go out with this guy, that's fine. And I'd be happy to be your best friend. I don't want to own you. I don't want to possess you. I want you to be free. And I couldn't believe I was saying that because the words, they didn't, first of all, it was like an out-of-body experience. They're not things I'd practiced. It was not an idea that I had. It was not like I came to some decision that, I have to do this. But it was as though I had touched somehow a deeper part of myself that, to my surprise, was not surprised at the betrayal, at the injury and the wrong. And that sense that had filled me for the past week or so of, how dare you? After all I've done for you, I gave up everything for you. How could you do this to me? And all of that was dead. And there was a part of me that simply wanted to love, and it simply wanted her to be free. And it was, as Aquinas says, love is willing the good of the other. It was a place from which I had no other desire but to will that, whatever was good for her. Yeah. I didn't determine that. And it was a place that I could just sort of gladly accept it. It was not resignation, but out of joy. So, right. So I was shocked by it, and she was even more shocked by that. And she didn't expect that from me because I was very jealous and possessive. And that was part of the reason why she was looking for another guy, was because mm-hmm. I was really, you know, controlling. So she ran off with this guy and then would, and I was just left in shock. And then for the next couple of weeks, she would call me about every day. Because now I was her best friend, I was her confidant. And then she had to tell me, oh, we went out to the movies and we held hands and we kissed and it was uncomfortable. But it was I recognized that for the first time, this is now I really love this person. Like, I don't, right. I'm not just using her. And that was, something changed there. And I didn't understand what was going on, but there was this very intuitive sort of recognition that this is better mm-hmm. than somehow, even though I don't have her, she's not mine, and I don't know where my life is going.
Yeah,
this is better. The other thing that changed was the violence in my household, which had, and again, it was this script that I had of my, you know, my complaining that my mom, you know, you'd ruin my life, you were a useless person, and I would curse at her, and curse at my dad for never taking her into treatment, because part of it is a stigma around mental illness, mm-hmm. and he didn't want to deal with that, and also didn't want to accept that this was a severe mental illness, and he kept saying, oh, it's just quirky behavior, you know, she'll improve, and watching her spiral, you know, into really sort of losing every sense of who she was. And so I was furious at him. But all of that sort of melted away in some sense. Not that I started to like my parents, but that anger felt meaningless. Mm-hmm. And so I really felt, the only word I could describe is dead. And mm-hmm. I felt like I had died at that retreat. And something new was being generated. And I didn't know what it was and why it was happening. But I could see that this had something to do with that experience of like, so if there is a God, he or she or it is doing something in me and to me, mm-hmm. which is odd. It's not, you know, something that I can judge very clearly. So 2 weeks of this girl calling me, she calls me one day in one of those conversations and says, I don't know what's happened, but you're not the same person. So let's get back together. And at this time, my other friends around me said, now you can stick it to her in the neck and show her what it feels like to be betrayed and reject her. And I didn't want to. And I really felt that all I want is simply for her to be loved. And if that's my role as her boyfriend, I'll do it. And if she leaves me for somebody else the following week, I'm happy to do that. Right. So we got back together, but she was no longer my God. She was not what I lived for.
Yeah.
But now what? And I didn't have any plans. I had no idea where my life was going. I was waiting for my exam results. You know, I tried to pick up some jobs in Dubai. It was very hard to come by anything that made any money without a, you know, college degree. I didn't know that you needed a college degree in order to have a meaningful income. So the only thing that was of interest was this choir. And so we there were these people, these young people who went to that retreat. A lot of us became part of the youth choir, and they would have these practices twice a week before Mass. And I became, she and I, as well as the guy who she betrayed me for, you know, we were all together in the choir. In fact, the three of us started a pop rock band together, you know, and so because we had a friendship that somehow was deeper than all of this drama. And in that choir, in the choir practices, I encountered the gospel for the first time. The claim that, because they would do a mini catechesis before the choir practice regularly, and the idea that God is a father, not an impersonal force, but a father, was a very strange idea for me. He was secondly a father who loved unconditionally. And the concept of unconditional love was new to me. I would not have believed it. For me, love was transactional. You know, you love mm-hmm. somebody, they have to, you know, to earn your trust and your love. But I'd experienced unconditional love. Right. I'd tasted it. And right. so I would not have been ready for this, you know, a few weeks ago. And now here I am hearing a concept that resonates with my experience and names what I've lived. And the proof of it is this naked man on the cross betrayed by his friends. Aha, that's another thing that I'd never experienced before, and now I did. And he comes back from the dead and doesn't, you know, punch Peter in the face and say, you know, you left me hanging there. So that kind of non-punitive, like, I mean, there was something in the story that you know, just a little while ago would have just seemed a ridiculous fairy tale, now mm-hmm. somehow resonated with, you know, this uncanny ability to name an experience that I'd been given that I had no other way to sort of put into words. And so I was, you know, I found myself interested in this. But the only reason I thought about baptism, I thought about becoming Christian was that this girl and I were together. And I thought, well, we'll probably get married. You know, our relationship is good now. We've sorted through sort of, you know, the difficulties and, you know, we'll likely be together. So I went to the head of the guy who there was this lay evangelist who had started a youth group there, and I told him I was thinking about this, you know, baptism and becoming a Christian. And he said, "Why? Who is Jesus to you?" And that was not a question I expected. Mm-hmm. So, you know, keep in mind, I'm here in this youth group regularly. Everyone knows I'm a Hindu. You know, I'm not. They also probably know I don't really believe in God or anything. Nobody asks me any questions. They're not, "Well, why are you here?" This is the first time I have a question being posed to me is when I go up and ask, you know, about baptism. I had no way to answer that question. I said, "I don't know who Jesus is. I think he's something powerful," or, you know, I mumbled something. And he asked me about my story and what happened, and I told him. He said, "Look, you know, Jesus he's alive, he's real, he's risen from the dead. He's a person that you can speak to, and he's touched your life. Obviously, he's done something. Look at your life and see, you know, something's changed. He's touched you. He's working in your life. So talk to him." I said, "Look, man, my mom talks to invisible people. That's not for me. I'm not going to sit and mumble." So he said, "All right, why don't you take a book, take a little notebook or piece of paper and write a letter as though you're writing to a friend and have a conversation with someone." I said, "All right, that I could do." So I went home that evening and bought a little, you know, stationery shop, bought a little orange notebook, and I started writing stuff that I didn't know had to be written. Questions inside of me, anger, perplexity, just what is happening? Like, what is going on? Who are you? Why are you real? And just sort of all of this stuff that kept pouring out for pages. And it was stuff that was so, it was hard for me to even face the questions I had. And so I would write one sentence over another until I tore through the page, just because I couldn't bear to see what was inside me. Mm. And then I found myself almost confronted with some sort of presence that was there, you know, which was all I could describe it as a presence of peace. I'm not just writing in a notebook. There was some other, you know, there. It kind of freaked me out a bit. And so I went back to this guy and said, "I need to, you know, here's what's happening. I need to understand what's going on." And fortunately, this guy was very well read and very well trained in theology. And so he had a lot of, you know, knowledge from Augustine and from the Church Fathers, from C.S. Lewis, from Thomas Merton, and sort of various people who he would sort of guide me to. And we had a lot of long conversations over several months where he had a job where he worked 3 days on and 3 days off. And on his off days, we would spend hours just sitting and talking through my questions about, "I don't believe in immaterial entities. How can this be real?" And, you know, Lewis's argument on the Lord, the Lunatic, and the Liar, and just right. So many different references that all just made a lot of sense to me. And so very quickly, from the point of my initial breakup with this girl to my eventual baptism, confirmation, and so on, the sacramental grand slam, all of that happened in 9 months.
Wow.
Very, very quickly, because this evangelist, as well as the parish priest and a few others, thought they needed me to make a decision soon, because I was going to leave to go to Canada, because it was cheaper than being in Dubai to go to college in Canada. So they very quickly sort of pushed me through a makeshift RCIA process where all I knew was the Eucharist is the risen Jesus, real and present, and the church is the continuity of the companionship that he's created. I knew nothing else at all, and it was enough for me. It was really just enough to say, "This is true, and I believe it," and the experience that had changed my not just my relationship with this girl, but with my family. It had helped me to see that my self-worth couldn't come from this girl or anyone else, but from an infinite source, and it's the same infinite source who loved my mom and my dad, and they value, you know, they were of value to him. And so it really changed the way I started to see them as well. And that was, I think, my deep struggle for years throughout my childhood was struggling with the question of, you know, in Indian culture, especially, you know, parents are everything, and the sense of duty to one's parents is so dominant, and I couldn't accept it. I couldn't accept that central aspect of Hinduism, your dharma and your sense of duty. And this somehow opened the door to helping me. I see now why they have value. I see now why I have a responsibility to them, you know, so.
It's almost that worldview, more than a particular theological point,
right.
It's almost like this worldview doesn't fit me,
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
And now you're encountering one that does, so that it begins to make sense out of both your wounds that you found in yourself, as well as then the experiences you had.
Let's
pause there just for a minute, and we'll take a little break. But we're excited to hear the rest of it. Real quickly, the comment too that what a great little moment of the proclamation of the gospel in your life from that youth minister.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I think we don't do it because we think it needs to be really complicated.
Right.
But it comes as simple as, like, do you know Jesus? And here's the basics.
Yeah.
You know, this is the basic worldview of the gospel, you know, but try it on, see if it fits. You know?
Right.
We'll dig into that more, though. So we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Brandon Vidyanathan's story. He's a former Hindu, and again, we've been hearing his story so far. He's the associate professor and chair, Department of Sociology at the Catholic University of America. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of that. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, we've got all sorts of stories. And if you're someone who's on a journey, we'd love to be walking with you, praying for you, assisting you in any way we can. So check out chnetwork.org and send us a message there. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dr. Brandon Vidyanathan. He's a former Hindu, associate professor and chair at the Department of Sociology at the Catholic University of America. And Brandon, again, we've been hearing your story. Really appreciate it so far. I love the theme that you brought out of, in this connection between, you know, and we all experience this, but you brought it, you know, it happened in your story in this poignant way of, like, this underlying brokenness that we all carry, we all feel, of needing to be loved, wanting to be loved, you know, and then you having this experience through a wound, through a, you know, a betrayal and some of the drama and relationship of experiencing God's love and having, just seeing how that slowly, you know, played out and opened you up. It's an amazing thing. That's really a bit of the heart of the gospel there, that we are broken and need to be loved in a way that we can't give to each other.
Yeah.
Right. We need God. Right. Yeah. We have a God-shaped hole. Right?
As Augustine would say, you're right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so that was, yeah, I mean, it's such a great grace to be given that opportunity, but, you know, as painful as it was, I mean, it was through that experience of allowing, you know, myself to enter into that brokenness, right? Mm-hmm. I think that, but there's nothing I could have done to manufacture, you know, that recognition of, you know, of someone who betrays you as someone who merits your love in some way, you know, and so that was really like, I can't manufacture that. And that, I think, has been at the heart of what I think has, over the years, kept me convinced that this is not just something I've made up. It's not just some choice I've made, but a powerful gift. And it's as though in that moment when I, you know, was able to recognize that really what I wanted most from this girl was nothing, but just simply to love her, for her to be free. And I wanted simply to be free to accompany her in whatever capacity she was made for. It was as though I touched a part of me that was more me than myself.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a recognition that I was so sure I knew who I was, and I was wrong, that I didn't even know who I was. But there is almost another, you know, who wants to accompany you and to live in you, right? And so much about what the Church teaches started to become very clear to me as I started to experience this understanding of what the sacraments are and what grace is and this sharing of God's life, right, in you.
So. I had one other thought just before we go on, and it's just that, you know, you began your story talking about how your experience of your Hindu faith as a child was very transactional. So prayer was transactional. I'm doing something. I'm acting to get something.
Yeah.
And even as Christians, look, so we recognize that we have intercessory prayer, and
we
bring to God our needs.
Yeah.
But the progression of your story, I think, is a good reminder to us, right? That the beginning and end of prayer is what God does, not what we do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's being there with God and being loved by Him.
Yeah.
It's only in the context of that, of His action, that then, yes, we pray for others and we bring God our needs and we work and cooperate with God. But the experience of his love,
yeah.
what he's doing. That's yeah. the foundation and the summit of prayer is really that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, so my journey, in a sense, just began with my entering the church in early 1999. As I said, I didn't have really any. I had some sort of informal background in theology, just through talking with this youth minister, who then went on. He became a priest a few years ago, but it was only after I moved to Canada that I really had to study. I had to really understand what the church taught, because my first community in Canada for several months was a group of fundamentalist Protestants who would keep interrogating me. Where's that in the Bible? And isn't the Pope the Antichrist? And Mother Teresa's going to hell, and she just works. And where's faith? And so I had to start dealing with a lot of those kinds of questions that emerge in, with many of your other sort of Protestant converts have to deal with. And I had to sort of begin to work through a lot of that and try to understand scripture and so that was the beginning of that. But then also, my conversion also unfortunately became for me a means to try to escape from my parents. Mm. And I had begun to accept them, but I didn't really start to love them. I could accept that God loved them. But for me, I was still, I saw them as, well, they're Hindu, and I didn't tell my parents that I'd been baptized for about a year after, because I didn't know how they would take it. I didn't really know, how they'd be affected by it. When I did tell them, my mother, she, of course, couldn't didn't. It's not clear how she processed it. My dad didn't seem to have any reaction at all, and I think he was of the opinion that. If you believe in God, no matter what you say, you're a Hindu. I mean, like, whoever you are, wherever you are in the world, right? I mean, so it's all the same, ultimately the same source. And he could see that something had changed. My relationship with him had changed, and I, began to treat him as a human being and with respect, as opposed to, I can't even describe the ways in which I used to treat him before. So something had changed and was real, for him, But I was still not willing to go back, and I didn't want to be, in some sense, contaminated by, as I saw it, the worldview of my parents and of what I'd left behind. So I saw it almost as though God has pulled me out of, out of Egypt and taken me to the Promised Land, which is Canada. And the name Brandon, which I was given, so it's not my original Hindu name, is Ram, mm-hmm. It's the name of a god, and that got bumped to my middle name because Brandon, I thought was apt because of Saint Brendan the Navigator, who went to Canada and who went to evangelize Canada. That's not the origin of the name that I was given. The name Brandon was chosen by my girlfriend at the time. Because I asked her, I told her, I need a Christian name for my confirmation. I need a saint's name. She's like, I like the name Brandon. I found out many, many years later, the reason she gave me that name was because she liked the show Beverly Hills 90210. Oh, and dear. That's what I'm named after, is the protagonist in that show.
God works in very mysterious ways.
So it's a bit of humility there. There's nothing, no grandeur there. An American soap opera character. So... the perfect boyfriend name for her, so she gets to choose that. But yeah, so I went to Canada, and then my girlfriend and I were together for a couple of years, and then we really had drifted apart. And by the time I got back, my faith had grown a lot, and it was really central to me. And it was, I was obsessed with reading theology and philosophy, and she just wanted a normal life in Dubai, I couldn't imagine returning to that world and living there, and I wanted to. I loved my professors at university and the academic life and the life of the mind, and all of this stuff just opened itself up to me as it had never been an option before. It was not something on the horizon, and I saw the possibility of, being able to live a life where you could ask big questions and think about the meaning of things. So that for me was incredibly appealing, and so anyway, the two of us drifted apart, and then we're still friends together, but today. I still had to deal with this question of what is my relationship with my parents and to Hinduism. And it was not until I encountered Newman a few years later where he talks about how conversion is not It's not the rejection of something to embrace something else, but it's the completion. It's the fullness of what you had always aspired to. And that was that was one thing. But then also, I went into seminary for a few months and was trying to discern the priesthood. And in seminary, about 4 or 5 years from the last time I saw my parents, I was in seminary, and I somehow got a phone call from my dad, who I had not been in touch with for a long time. He managed to track me down, and said, what's the matter? You've not reached out. You've not talked to us, and we're in the hospital. And that was a shock. He didn't tell me anything else. He said, you need to come back, and we're in the hospital, your mom and I. So I was like, okay. And I was trying to discern what to do, and I was praying, and I would see on the crucifix, I'd see my parents suffering, and I felt like I'd completely betrayed them. And so I thought I had to go back. So I left seminary, returned, and I realized that in the hospital meant he had fractured his wrist. It was very minor, but he sort of needed to do something to get me back. And then that was the beginning of realizing that I don't have to escape from India or from Hinduism. I mean, there's so much God is present here too. It's not my whole quest to try to become a Canadian Catholic and create a new life for myself, a new identity, was all some sort of fear-driven, ego-driven quest that ultimately was not from God. And so, but I was using my faith almost as a means to propel that pursuit. So anyway, that just opened me up to realizing that there was a lot more. I could start to embrace my parents, for who they were, and could see what was good about their faith. I started studying Hinduism a bit and trying to understand more about Indian culture and Indian society, and also about the Emirates and about Islam. And so, I mean, it was through Catholicism that I could learn to value the truth and the beauty and the goodness that exists in these other faiths. And I had not realized that God is so much bigger, so much more expansive. I couldn't put him in a little box. And so through that journey, I eventually ended up going back to Canada. I ended up from there meeting my wife, who was, she was a student in Canada, and she's American. She moved to the States, and then I moved to the States to start a graduate program, and became a sociologist, started working in university, and
Wonderful. Oh, well, bring us a bit to the present now. What's happened after all that?
Yeah. So, one thing was, in pursuing my academic work, I ended up somewhat unexpectedly becoming a sociologist. It was not a field that I was interested in when I was in college. But I began to see the value of doing empirical research. So how the world actually works, how people actually function, how organizations actually function. And learning how to do surveys and interviews and ethnography and those sorts of methodologies to understand not just how things ought to be or how people ought to behave, but what really is the case, right? And so the tools and methodologies and theories needed for that, I came to really value and really felt led into that world. Having done that as a sociologist, becoming a professor, trying to do a lot of research in organizational culture. I studied corporate life, looking at how people negotiate their tensions between faith and work, and what happens when you're a Christian or person of another faith trying to live in structures that are sometimes antithetical to allowing you to live out a fully, not even a fully religious or spiritual life, but even a fully human life. Because it can be very exploitative, and the ways in which I think chasing after short-term profits can really be corrosive on who we are, and also just general human dynamics. When we come together as people, there's a lot of good that comes out of communities, but a lot of tensions and politics and ways in which we want to mistreat each other and so on. Whether it's in business or in the church, it's the same dynamics. We're human beings, right? So studying that kind of work has been really eye-opening for me, and in my teaching, I've also been really trying to help my students understand difficult issues like mental illness is not just an individual problem, but a social problem. And in America, for instance, a large percentage of the prison population is severely mentally ill, and so the challenges with how we build our social structures and policies in ways that prevent us from flourishing. All of that is really important, and I think that work has been For me, very much driven by the gospel, very much I see it as something I'm not naturally drawn to, you know, like understanding poverty and working with people who are poor. I don't do that for my research, but it's a large part of my teaching, and I feel it's a way of the Lord to sort of keeping me grounded and helping me realize that, you know, yeah, you study elites. So, because I study scientists and I study, you know, church leaders and I study business professionals, but don't pretend that that's the world. Like, there's so much more that we need to understand and keep in front of us at all times.
Well, I feel like it's a classic example of the right connection between faith and science, in the sense of it's faith seeking understanding. This idea that we can start from a mere materialism or a mere kind of functionalism or transactional view of human beings and then work our way up to a coherent worldview or meaningful life, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
But we begin by encountering truth, goodness, and beauty, encountering God, encountering the gospel. So we have this, it's from that place of faith that actually now we drill down into these things and we can really just, you know, work out the truths amongst these more grounded things, the realities of human life. Coming in that direction, that's what's happened throughout human history, right? It's been those men of faith, men and women of faith, who have, you know, pioneered science and sociology and all these other areas.
With our certainty that there's something that we can know about reality and that, then that can help us to flourish and overcome the challenges we face and so on. And so that is a conviction. If you're a scientist, you have to have that kind of hope. You have to have that sort of faith. Otherwise, you know, why bother? You know,
right? The question "why bother?" That's not a scientific question.
Yeah,
why bother? That's a religious and philosophical question.
Exactly. Yeah. No, so it's been such a great privilege. I feel so blessed that I get to do what I do and people pay me for it. And, you know, it's been just a joy of learning how God works through social realities and to communicate this to others through writing or teaching or speaking or the other things
right.
I do.
Yeah. Has it all been at Catholic University of America?
Largely, yeah. I've been, this is where I've worked as a professor. I worked for a foundation, nonprofit foundation before that. I was at Rice University before, so a few other places, but this has really been, I think, in many ways, my professional home. You know, and I appreciate being at a place like Catholic U because of its commitment to integrating faith and reason, and that's really what a lot of my work is trying to do. Yeah,
very good. Well, let's circle back a little bit on a couple topics. We have, you know, a little bit of time left here.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we were talking about beforehand, and it comes out in your story, I think, is precisely sort of this Catholic worldview that's able to embrace truth, goodness, and beauty. Wherever we find it, you know, it contrasted with kind of a, and it's funny because you had the experience with those fundamentalists. You did talk about that. Maybe you can bring out some more of those discussions. But a view where there's a real suspicion about the rest of the world versus a Catholic, a universal view that kind of embraced truth, goodness, and beauty. Talk about your experience of that and how you've come to see it now as you're part of your journey.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. I mean, you'd asked a lot, you know, about my sort of early experience of Christianity. One of the things that I should note is there is a stereotype in India of Catholics, and it's the people who are drinking and dancing, and their women wear skirts, and it's a very sort of liberal view that others look upon with suspicion. This is very foreign. It's very Western, but it's also kind of that liberality, the kind of the freeness, the sense of freedom. I was attracted to that as a kid. The idea that there's something. I mean, I didn't care about religion, but that way of life where there's an openness as opposed to rules and strictures. And in the West, when you think of, like, you know, stereotypically think of Catholicism, you think of the rules, you think of Catholic guilt, and you think of all that. But that's not the Indian stereotype. It's the exact opposite. And so I think in my sort of my religious journey, I think one of the things that I struggled early on was with the kind of rule-based or the kind of more closed approach where I was told by people in the church that, oh, you should avoid, you know, spending time with Hindus or with certain kinds of Catholics and so on because they'll corrupt you and you know, so and maybe there is a need, you know, at certain times to, you know, immerse yourself, you know, with people who are But as I went on, I just felt that it can't be that the world, the rest of humanity, is just lost, and the time that I spent with those fundamentalists, I mean, the criteria for who is actually saved and who's actually worth spending time, it was so narrow, and there's no room for, well, what about all these other people, and, you know, how do you deal with them, and so but I had to learn, like, what does it mean to to be open to that. And it was not until, like, it was much after I graduated college, but my undergrad university motto was Philippians 4:8, whatsoever things are true and good and beautiful, you know. So that kept, and over again, I mean, I remember being at ceremonies, I had to read this, and I would read that scripture verse over and over, and I think it's sort of, it's very providential that it was given to me, but it's hammered itself way deep into my soul. Like, that's really what, you know, St. Paul is urging us to recognize in reality, where God is present in all things, not just in your narrow little community. And what does it mean for the church to possess the fullness of truth, right? It doesn't mean we shut our doors and sit on some treasure chest, but it has to do something with excavating in all of reality the way to understand these truths, the way to sort of highlight beauty, which is a lot of the work I do these days is on the concept of beauty and beauty outside of the arts. So, in the Catholic world, many of us think of beauty and we think of Palestrina or you know, Michelangelo or something. There's a lot more beauty than that, right? And not even just in nature, but even in the work we do, as whether as scientists or as lawyers or as business people or you know, whatever. And that's the kind of journey that I'm being led to is I think God wants us to recognize in all of reality that which is attractive. It can mislead us. Beauty is you know, can be untethered from truth and goodness. Yeah. But we shouldn't throw it out. We shouldn't be purely suspicious of it. I think there's something about our faith that gives us the confidence with which we can approach this and handle it as almost as snake charmers would, the things that are, you know, a little bit dangerous, but our faith can equip us to do that, I think.
Yeah, and I think there's lots of reasons for that in our Catholic faith. One of them, Chesterton articulates it as that when you have fixed points of doctrine, when you know precisely what you believe in, we are a propositional faith. I mean, you can open up the catechism and the catechism will tell you black and white, this is what we believe about Jesus, this is what he is, this is what he isn't. And the modern mind hears that kind of, you know, sharp doctrinal edges and thinks, oh, that's going to keep people apart, that's going to make us...
Right.
And Chesterton pointed out, you know, 100 years ago, that the opposite's true.
Yeah.
When you know precisely what you believe, well, then you have this freedom to walk right up to the edge of somebody else, because you know, like, we agree all this, and it's only here that we disagree.
Right.
So you're able to be... Yeah. You're able to come very close to lots of other things because you know precisely where the lines.
Yeah,
lay.
And there are challenges, right? Like, I mean, I have so much fondness for, affection for my Muslim friends, and we have very serious disagreements about the reality of Jesus. Did he die? Did he resurrect? Right? I mean, those are serious disagreements, but there's so much else that we share in common, and who knows when that those disputes how. God will solve that problem. That really seems like there's still so much that is out of our hands, but we can, that doesn't mean we approach each other with suspicion, but we journey together in pursuit of truth, and we celebrate the beauty and goodness that we can bring about in the world together, right? And the same with Hinduism too, which there's so much that I've been learning, and I think, again, it's through my now Catholic lenses that I can see and appreciate things that I never would have been able to, never would have been interested in as a kid, and yet that doesn't mean that I'm not a Catholic, right? To be able to appreciate that.
Well, it seems like on the one hand, the more theoretical point is just that God is not a player within the universe; He's God of reality, and so, you know, we would expect Him to, you know, He's we're going to find Him everywhere. His fingerprints can be everywhere. The moral relational point, though, and that's kind of what you're highlighting there a little bit, is that recognizing that God made each human being, He loves them, He endowed them with intellect and free will, and they are on a journey, right? And so when we encounter them, we're not encountering someone who's like somehow cut off from God completely.
Exactly.
God's in and working in their lives.
Yeah.
And so we want to share the gospel, but we can do it with a gentle touch because God loves them more than we do. He knows them better than we do. And our role is to help them just take whatever is the next step in their life. Right?
And that can enrich us too, right? And there are people, I mean, I've very dear friends who are no longer believers, and you know, yet all of our conversations and our time together is mutually enriching, right? And I think that there's something that we can try to offer them in that's grounded in our certainty about truth, and yet there's insights into how people live and how God is working their lives, where we go, wow, you know, I look at some of these folks and say, you know, I need to be doing that.
But, right.
You know,
so. Yeah, we can remain open to, you know, the opportunities God gives us to share our story, to share the gospel, you know, and be praying for people too. I mean, talk a little bit about that too. We started the story with prayer, very transactional, cold sort of view of what prayer is. Talk about what that looks like now.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's entirely, I mean, the way I think have come to, maybe that the, you know, the thing that, one of the things that really changed my my mind about God was when I would spend time with this you know, youth minister slash priest now, what I found striking was that he could access God, like in conversation. And so he would pray with me. And his prayer was always just, it was a deeply intimate conversation with somebody who was with us, who I couldn't see. And that conversation was more intimate than any conversation I had had with even my girlfriend, right? It was such a, there was such a level of deep relational connection. And so, you know, when people talk about God as a sort of impersonal, like, a, you know, you can think about, a lot of people say, you know, God, I can admit a higher power, but it's impersonal. But personality is so much greater than impersonality, right? And so to have that kind of power, I mean, the power of being present in a relationship, to me, is far greater than the power of creating stuff, creating stars and galaxies. That seems to wane in comparison. And so for me, that the prayer now is entering into that relationship with one who is, you know, more intimate with me than I can be with anyone else or even with myself, right? And so, God has sort of pure relationship, and the Trinity is sort of trying to, I think the truth of the doctrine of the Trinity is trying to communicate that there is deep relationality, and that's what has to transform us and teach us how to be, you know, capable of relating in that manner to the people around us. You know, what does it mean for me to love my children and to love my wife is to be in that kind of relationship with them.
Absolutely. I think we forget about that connection sometimes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a helpful analogy, right? You know, when we think about sometimes the ways we struggle to be present to our wives and our children and our people around us, you know, that same dynamic is going on in prayer. It's important what we say and what we're doing and where we're at and all that kind of thing, but that presence, that being present to another person who's really there, that's the heart of prayer. It's the heart of relationship. And so you can get kind of the externals right, but forget that, the heart of it is whether I'm actually being present to this other person. And of course, in relationship to God, am I being open and receptive to them, you know, more than anything else? That's the bigger thing.
So that's sort of, I think, at the heart of it, in spite of, you know, all the transactional, like I need to know how to pay the bills and all that sort of, there are those kinds of prayers too, but this is, you know, the heart of it.
We locate those in their context of that relationship. Well, we've just got about a couple minutes left. And so if you just take a moment to share a word of encouragement, if there's somebody who's in a similar place that you were, coming from a background, you know, maybe very far away from Christ, maybe someone who really has that sense of brokenness, of maybe having been betrayed, needing to be loved, share a word of encouragement to them.
I would say that God is really a God of surprises. And you know, I would just say, have the courage to ask, and just ask boldly, and ask God to reveal Himself to you, and even to say, you know, if you're real, show me. I need to know, and see what happens, and you know, allow yourself to be surprised. Allow yourself to go to that place where the things that you're clinging on to, the things that you think really matter, the things that you can't let go of, even if all of that's taken away, there's still something deeper. Someone who is there to catch you and who's there with you, and when you encounter that presence, you know, you'll be more you than yourself, and then you'll live, you know, in much more freedom than you can ever imagine. I think that for me is at the heart of saying yes to Jesus, allowing Him to come and be present to us, allowing the Holy Spirit to come and transform us, and to live then in obedience to reality given to us by a Father who loves unconditionally. It's not Monty Python's foot stamping you out, which is how I used to see reality. But it's in spite of the challenges, in spite of things that look bleak, there is a promise, and there's something that you can confidently move towards, trusting that He will bring you to fullness and you know, to completion of all that you deeply long for and deeply desire.
Amen. Well, thank you so much, Brandon.
Thank you, John.
Appreciate you and appreciate you joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Dr. Brandon's story is an inspiration to you. Again, it's a great privilege that we have here to hear a story and to reflect on that reality that Brandon was sharing with us. You know, that the heart of our faith is this encounter with God. And we have this great gift of the Catholic Church through the sacraments, through prayer, to draw near to a God who has already drawn near to us. It's a great gift, and it's great to be here celebrating it with you. I want to remind you that if you go to chnetwork.org, you've got all sorts of stories like Brandon's from every conceivable background of people who have come to know Jesus Christ and his church. Check that out at chnetwork.org. We'll be back again next week with another story. See you then.